listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Rachel.
It is a book club wrap-up day. This was such a fun book club. A long-awaited book club. Rachel, what are we doing?
What are we doing? We are talking through C.S. Lewis's classic fiction. It's sort of hard to classify, but no, it's a novel. An epistolary novel is the exact genre.
Oh,
the Screwtape Letters. One of the most famous works of 20th century sacred literature, which is why I was so surprised and pleased when I heard you had never read it, Sarah. So we had to do it.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. And I'm glad we did.
Yes. So this book, if you're not familiar with it, one, that's kind of rare, but good for you. If you're not familiar with it, it takes the form of a series of correspondence. We only see one side, but these are letters from Screwtape, a senior devil in the lowerarchy of hell, which is imagined as this giant bureaucracy, and I just love it. But he's writing tidbits of advice and guidance to his nephew, Wormwood, who is a junior tempter out on the field. Think a field agent. And he is trying to tempt the, quote, patient to abandon his newly found Christian faith and give in to the world with all its pleasures and temptations. How successful these devils are at achieving their goal is one of the beautiful parts of the book. Spoiler, they aren't. But along the way, we just learn a whole lot about what temptation looks like, what spiritual warfare looks like, about the Christian life and the challenges therein. And we also learn, ironically, a lot about the nature of God's love for us, because Screwtape is constantly scratching his head, trying to understand and deconstruct a kind of love that he is unable to comprehend ultimately. So it's a great book, so quotable. We'll get to that later. And I have read it so many times at this point. I would say I reread it at least every year or two, or at least have for the last 10 years. And it's short, it is punchy, and I don't get tired of it. But that's my experience with it. I'd love to hear your experience with it, especially our newbie, Sarah. What did you think?
I loved it, but I fully expected to love it. So that wasn't really all that surprising. I remember from my childhood paging through it. I don't know how old I was, but I know my parents have a copy of it somewhere in their house. And I remember paging through it and thinking it was a wild and awesome book when I was just a little kid. So it was fantastic. I shouldn't be surprised, but I'm always surprised at how culturally relevant C.S. Lewis is, even though he did not write in our current culture. His writing is still so, so relevant. I think I was sending you guys quotes from like the first letter and I was like, this is so mind blowing. he just has this way of pointing out things that you know are true, but like he says them in a way that strike you a little differently and make you really think about stuff and make you see culture and religion and God in just this different way. And I love books that make me do that. Like I don't know that I really like learn new mind-blowing things, but I learn a different viewpoint and a different way to think about the world around me. And that's probably some of the favorite things that I ever read. So it was great. I got the hardcover because if I have an option, I always opt for hardcover. It just is so wonderful. The annotated version. And I wasn't sure about annotations because I think maybe Rachel, you said sometimes they're just annoying because it's stuff that you're like, I already know this.
Yeah.
This doesn't actually add to my experience. And some of it, like talking about the church year, I was like, okay, well, I know what a church year is. I know the references to scripture he's talking about. So those weren't all that interesting. But there were a lot of other annotations of like explaining what a word means or especially pointing out the references, because there's a long introduction in this, and I read all that too. Lewis quotes things or refers to stuff in popular culture mm-hmm. that people at his time would have probably understood. Like he assumes that his readers are well-read and understand the things that he's referring to. And I am not a well-read person from what, the 1940s. So I don't know all of the references that he's alluding to in these letters. And those annotations were helpful to just understand why he's bringing this up or the deeper meaning behind what he's actually saying. Mm-hmm. So it took me a lot longer to read this, even though it is short, because I was reading most of the annotations. And there's a lot of annotations in some of these letters.
Okay.
So
you mean that lines like the sham Gothic erection on the new building estate are not perfectly clear?
Yeah. Well,
and I'm looking at your book that you have in your hands. It is a lot bigger than I expected.
Yeah.
Like it's
huge.
It's wide.
It's big.
It's not.
Okay. While we're comparing editions, I have to show you mine.
Yeah. It's almost just.
Maybe we'll send
like
photos.
1/3 annotation, 2/3. Content on each page,
and some of the pages are full. Like you've got the full script of the book, and then the other column is completely full of annotations. Yeah. Like it is so much extra information. Like this one I just opened up to, Lewis refers to Coleridge, the poet, who I know, but the annotation is the entire poem that he's referring to.
That's cool.
So it is actually. Okay. It takes a lot longer and you kind of, you have to like reread stuff to understand it more. But if you love C.S. Lewis and you love Screwtape Letters and you want a deeper dive into all of the things, and maybe you aren't a well-read person from the 1940s, it was really interesting for me to have all that extra information.
So Rachel, I suspect yours is also annotated, but perhaps more hand annotated.
I think they're annotated.
Mine is not annotated in the slightest, except that it says... It is inscribed at the front, Daryl somebody or other, I am 1144.
Okay. Wow.
So this is one of the early editions, 1944. Uh-huh. It's a hardbound.
Yes.
At this point, by the same author list at the front has The Pilgrim's Regress, Out of the Silent Planet, and The Problem of Pain. He hadn't even finished the Space Trilogy at this point.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So this would have been the 9th reprint.
Wow.
Okay.
And it was a U.S. edition. And we go straight into the two quotes at the beginning, a 2-page preface, right into letter one. And the book actually ends, and I mentioned this in the book club, my book ends without the epilogue, Screwtape proposes a toast, because that was actually written some years after this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
There are no footnotes, no annotations. It's just text.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love it.
Uh-huh.
It's one of the treasures of my house.
Yeah.
Now I have several other editions of Screwtape, including one from I think the 60s or 70s that is the front cover art is just spectacularly bizarre. You know, like they were back then.
Yes.
But this one is special just because it is just the book. And that's it. And I love it.
Yeah.
So we had opposite reading experiences, Sarah.
Yeah. In the end, as often happens, I chose to do the audiobook.
Excellent. Of the
Sandman, which I haven't listened to one before, but I suspected would be great. And it truly was.
Who was the narrator?
The narrator is Joss Ackland.
Oh.
And he couldn't have been a better narrator.
Oh, good.
It was everything I imagined Screwtape.
Oh, that's excellent.
No. Yeah, Screwtape would be. At first I was like, no, Wormtail. No, but it was Screwtape narrating it. It was, masterful.
I'm going to have to check that out. I have been looking for an audiobook edition that could top the one I heard years ago and cannot now find.
Oh, okay.
There is somewhere out there, and I wish Audible would acquire it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
There is an audiobook version of this narrated by John Cleese.
Okay.
Of Monty Python.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he is so good.
Yeah.
But it sounds like what you've got there is sort of comparable, probably.
Yeah. It was really excellent. And I actually, it is available as a standalone, but Audible has it. And that's who I get my books through. They have it as part of a collection. And so you can buy it like one for all that includes a number of other nine essential works in one. So it includes Mere Christianity, Screwtape Letters, The Great Divorce. They aren't all narrated by the same person. There's a few different narrators. So they took a number of some of the shorter ones and combined them into one, which makes it even more bang for your buck. But honestly, it was worth it just for the Screwtape Letters. I will end up listening to some of the others. I haven't done all of those, but that'll be interesting. So yeah, thoroughly enjoyed that. I have read it in the past, but hearing it, I feel like the, what did you call it? Epistolary novel. Nature of it, even it lends itself either, I feel like equally well to either reading as if it were a letter or like listening to someone essentially, you know, tell you this thing. So hearing from a single voice reading this really, really was a fun experience. So yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it as I have in the past. And as almost always happens when I read Lewis, in the moment, I'm like, I understand this so perfectly. He's captured it so beautifully. Mm-hmm. And then like afterwards, I'm like, I cannot put that in my own words.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. He captured it so thoroughly that I would need way more words to try and express what he has distilled down into like this beautiful expression that cuts right to the heart of it. So yeah, really enjoyed it thoroughly.
That's good. Yeah. I did too. But then I always do.
Yeah,
that's
why I'm impressed by your annual tradition of spending time with Screwtape.
Well, we just keep coming back to it. Mm-hmm. It's one of the few books that all of my kids will consent to listen to on a road trip. Mm-hmm. And so it gets a lot of play that way.
That's fine.
Yeah, definitely.
But we need to talk about the structure of the book, this epistolary novel, because it is a very narrow perspective.
Mm.
We see everything through Screwtape's lens. And Screwtape himself is not actually on the ground. He's only privy to whatever Wormwood sends him in his letters, which we don't see. We don't get Wormwood's perspective. Mm-hmm. We don't get the patient's perspective. We don't get the heavenly perspective. Somewhat, one of our lurking ladies in our book club pointed that out, wondering why Lewis didn't bother to include both sides of the spiritual warfare.
Yeah.
Here we have just Screwtape, just one mid-level demon in the lowerarchy who is giving his advice on a series of instances in this man's life.
Mm-hmm.
One, I want to talk about, how does this either sharpen or diminish the effect of the book? But two, the sheer audacity of Lewis basically taking on the persona of this demon. Like, I'm not sure as a writer, I would have the guts to do that. To basically descend into the mind of a demon for 31 letters.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think?
I like diving into the wild psychology of the human mind. So I think I would find it a very interesting writing practice to do.
Well, that might explain why there are so many Screwtape fan fiction novels out there. A lot of people have tried to sort of riff off of this theme.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I feel like there's some catharsis there because, like, we all know these things. Like, we all have this experience of temptation and dealing with the evils of the world, and like being able to put some of that from evil's perspective, I think might be somewhat cathartic, like write out what is happening from the other perspective. I don't know.
I feel like there's also an element of like really excellent comedy does this.
Yes.
Where it takes you off guard and then it allows like these like really hard hitting things to like sneak in under your guard because you've let your guard down because you're like, oh, this is funny, this is amusing.
And it is. It's a really funny book.
Oh, wait a second. What? Yeah, that's so it's I feel like that's partly what he was able to do because he took the demon's perspective. I don't think it would have been able to be comedic if it were he probably could have made it comedic if it were an angel, but I feel like that would have been harder.
Yeah,
because then you risk if you're taking it comedic, it would have been risking mocking the devils, yeah. Who cares? Mm-hmm. You mock the devil all you want. Right. Mocking angels, like, that's a riskier business.
It's true. We're not
to fall into that.
Yeah.
I also wondered, as I was considering this question, I was, what came to my mind, and I had to find it and look it up. It was the part of the prologue to Bright Valley of Love.
Oh.
One of our earlier book club reads a few years ago. It was one of the OGs, I think.
Yeah. But
anyway.
Yeah.
And so I looked it up, and there was a quote in there that has stuck with me, but I wanted to get it right. So I pulled the exact quote up, and it was, a very wise woman, Simone Vail was her name. She once wrote that imagined evil is fascinating and inviting, while real evil is deadening and repellent.
Yeah.
But imagined good is dull and uninteresting, while real good is fascinating and inviting. Mm-hmm. And I've thought about that a number of times through the years.
Absolutely.
That quote has just really stuck with me. And I feel like there might be some application here in considering why Lewis chose to go with the imagined evil in this case. Because again, it wouldn't be a true story, so it would have to be imagined good. I just feel like it would lose its punch.
It would be dull, yeah.
So,
yeah. And you're right. I think by sneaking in the real good through the mode of imagined evil, it's really, really powerful.
Yeah.
You also, you pointed out the humor in this. And I think I just was flipping forward to the chapter on humor.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Where he defines the joke proper as that which turns on sudden perception of incongruity. Mm-hmm. The incongruity here is what really comes through and just adds a little zest to every page.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I also really have to share this quote that I unearthed when I was writing that essay for Lutheran Witness on Paradise Lost, because Lewis wrote a lengthy preface to Paradise Lost, a book that also includes a lengthy portions of it from the perspective of Satan and the other demons.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, to make a character worse than oneself, it is only necessary to release imaginatively from control some of the bad passions which in real life are always straining at the leash. The Satan within each of us is always there and only too ready, the moment the leash is slipped, to come out and have in our books that holiday we try to deny him in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, knowing that we are all captive to our sin nature, that we are all, whether we want to or not, sort of entranced with the wickedness all around us. I think it was really actually probably easier than he would have liked to write Screwtape, because all he had to do was let his inner sin nature off the leash a little bit and it all came out. I thought that was an interesting quote put in juxtaposition with this book in particular.
I think it also works well because we're reading about things from the devil's perspective, but we also know the ending of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that all of this has been redeemed by Christ. Mm-hmm. So it is amusing and funny because the devil has already lost. So
And we'll talk about the ending in a little bit, but you're right that if Screwtape and Wormwood win, this book is not fun anymore.
No.
This book is very dark and very depressing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If they win.
Mm-hmm.
So let's speed along here so we can get to talking about the ending. The third question we talked about in the book club this week. And by the way, I want to say thank you to the 83 ladies who joined us online for what will go down, as they all do, but this one as well, will go down in history as one of my favorite book club discussions. There's so many good insights that came out in this group. It was really fun. But the third question we talked about is, what do we learn about temptation in this book? Because that's really what it's about, is how we are tempted and how that temptation might surprise us if we stop to think about it. So I'll throw it out there. What did you guys learn about temptation from the Screwtape letters?
There's a lot of, it's like the slow roll. Mm. There wasn't a lot of like outright, we're going to drop this temptation in his lap. There's a lot of like, we're going to take this thing that's good and very slowly over time, we're going to twist it so he doesn't know it's happening. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, he will be ours because he has not realized that the thing that he was clinging to that was good is now something evil. And that comes across, I think, in a lot of the, if not most of the chapters, like all of these different perspectives of things that are slow and insidious. And I mean, I know this to be true, but reading that reminded me that like any good gift can be slowly twisted into an idol that ends up being like all of a sudden you're like, oh no, I have made an idol out of this thing that was originally a good gift. And now it's the only thing I can think about in my entire life. And I am obsessed with it. And
Oh, even as you're saying this, I'm feeling convicted. Bro, Sarah.
But it it's just,
but that's good. I need to
help it. Like that's just, that's what happens with so many things because of how we are.
Right.
That's sinful human nature.
Right.
I was thinking the same thing, like the idea of taking something that is good and twisting it. The other thing that I was struck with, sort of similar along those lines, is he called it out a number of times in the story that they cannot create anything.
We've tried. We've tried. I'm still working. We have yet to create a virtue, but one of these days our team of researchers will uncover that. And like the devil doesn't have the ability to create anything. All he can do is work with the good gifts that are already there. Yep. Like he's limited to that. He can't create something new. So his only option, therefore, is to try and twist it just a little bit. Mm-hmm. He can't do anything from scratch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the little temptations, the boiling the frog, which is kind of what's going, and the idea of so much of what the tempter does is suggest.
Yeah.
Constantly suggest to distract. Well, as soon as the patient tries to pray, we're going to try and distract him from those prayers. Mm-hmm. As soon as he sets foot in church, we're going to distract him by paying attention to the other people around him and the squeaky boots and the oily smile and the, you know, all these little distractions and these are small things. Like we think of it, I think that comes through in the book a lot, that we are often on guard against great temptations to great sins. Mm-hmm. But the little sins, the little temptations, they'll do the trick if we let them go unaddressed.
Yeah.
And that comes through over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're a lot harder to see, to understand that it's happening too. Mm-hmm. To like catch yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A lot of subtlety in the spiritual warfare.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't believe anyone ever pulls out a flaming sword. Whole lot of whispering going on. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we need to talk about how quotable this book is. Because as I was preparing to read it again, I began to fully take stock of how many lines from this book are just in my mind all the time. Mm. Have taken up residence in my head and are regular features of my own inner monologue. I know this because every time I go to quote one in a piece of writing, it doesn't work because it's backward, because it's screw tape. Like the concept is there and it is said so beautifully and so clearly, but I can't quote the enemy, you know?
Uh-huh.
And it's all sort of on its head, incongruous.
Uh-huh.
And so, yes, but it is extremely quotable. And so one of the questions that I asked in the group was simply to have people share their favorite quotes from the book. So I will give you both the opportunity to do that, too. And then I will share one or two from the group that people pointed out as being particularly felicitous quotations.
Okay, so I will pick one. And this gets at a little bit of what we were just discussing about the twisting. And so it, and I'm sorry, because I listened to it and the version I listened to had chapters, but they did not number the chapters.
Oh.
They opened each chapter anyway.
Interesting.
So there were definitely clear chapters, but it would be very hard for me to number it. I'd have to literally go to the start of the audiobook and then physically count. Anyway, but the quote is this. I did carefully write it down. So only today I found a passage in a Christian writer where he recommends his own version of Christianity on the ground that only such a faith can outlast the death of old cultures and the birth of new civilizations. You see the little rift? Believe this, not because it is true, but for some other reason.
Mm.
That's the game. And so just the idea of taking what is actually pretty close. You found it.
It's in chapter 23 because I also have marked chapter 23.
Yes.
It's the very end. 23.
Yeah. No, it was just, I was just like, it did. It sounded like if you don't look at it closely, it's not like he's saying wrong thing. Faith can outlast the death of old cultures, and this faith will outlast the birth of new, beyond the birth of new civilizations. That's true. It's just that's not why we believe it.
Right.
And so it's just this tiny little thing that gets in there, and then those sort of little cracks, they build up.
Mm-hmm.
They accumulate. So that was one. I'll let you go with one now.
And I can tell you from the annotation that Christian writer is the American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr.
Ooh. In
Interpretation of Christian Ethics from 1935.
Okay. Interesting.
Mm. That definitely does add some. That annotation was worth it because I know Reinhold Niebuhr.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And I know the thought that he put forward, and I know the fruits of that thought, a century later. And Lewis was smart.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So I also was in letter 23.
Yeah. It was a good letter.
It was a good letter. Yes. So partially because I was coming off of my class, my first class, where we talked extensively about the historical critical method, which would have been becoming very, very popular at this time. And Lewis talks at length, or I guess Screwtape talks at length, about getting the patient to believe in the historical Jesus, which is exactly what historical critical method is focused on, the historicity of everything rather than the fact that it's actually the word of God. And he just talks, I don't even know if I have a specific quote about this. Oh, in the last generation, we promoted the construction of such a historical Jesus on liberal and humanitarian lines. We are now putting forward a new historical Jesus on Marxian, catastrophic, and revolutionary lines. Like, oh boy.
Oh, yeah.
So like every generation, he's saying, like, has their own kind type of historical Jesus that they want to believe and focusing on that.
That is a totally legitimate observation, by the way. I've done some reading into historical Jesus literature, and
it's
every
terrible.
Time it reflects the society that has done the research.
And it also, I think this will make sense. The earliest converts were converted by a single historical fact, the resurrection, and a single theological doctrine, the redemption, operating on a sense of sin, which they already had, and sin not against some new fancy dress law produced as a novelty by a great man, but against the old platitudinous universal moral law, which they had been taught by their nurses and mothers. The gospels come later and were written not to make Christians, but to edify Christians already made. The historical Jesus then, however dangerous he may seem to us at some particular point, is always to be encouraged. So being aware of what culture tells us to believe about Jesus rather than what the Bible actually says about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Just, that was a stabby one.
Yeah. Another one came, I'm guessing it must be maybe chapter 24. It was shortly after the first one. So it could be chapter 24, it could be 25. But it was the one where he started talking about time and rhythm And this aligned, it just drew to mind our conversation that we had recently with Dr. Fickenscher about the church year and the flow of that. And the quote I have there is this: the humans live in time and experience reality successively. To experience much of it, therefore, they must experience many different things. In other words, they must experience change. And since they need change, the enemy, being a hedonist at heart, has made change pleasurable to them, just as he has made eating pleasurable. But since he does not wish them to make change any more than eating an end in itself, he has balanced the love of change in them by a love of permanence. He has contrived to gratify both tastes together in the very world he has made by that union of change and permanence, which we all call rhythm. He gives them the seasons, each season different, yet every year the same, so that spring is always felt a novelty, yet always as the recurrence of an immemorial theme. He gives them in his church a spiritual year. They change from a fast to a feast, but it is the same feast as before. He then goes on to, of course, as you would expect with Screwtape, you know, consider here's my advice for how you can take advantage of this. That particular paragraph, I thought, it resonated with me and just what I know about of life and how I experience change. Right. Permanence and the love of the change. And I love when the change is the same.
Yes.
And I'm like, I want my fall. I don't want this fall to be a warm fall. I want fall to be a delightful, crisp fall like falls should be.
It's ironic that we're recording this the day before St. Louis is supposed to get hammered with the snowstorm that we get.
We're only going to get about 2 inches here, but we are so excited because winter is supposed to have snow.
Yes.
And here in southeastern Virginia, this is like maybe a once or twice a year deal. And we treasure it because of exactly we crave the seasonal change.
Yeah. And I want it. Mm-hmm. I want the change to be the same change.
What the change is supposed to be.
Yes.
Winter needs snow. Fall needs pretty leaves.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Spring needs flowers.
Yep.
Summer needs fireflies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that is so letter 25, by the way.
Okay.
Yes, letter 25.
Thanks.
I'll share the quote that I shared in the group to get everyone started.
Yeah.
But then I'll share a couple of quotes from other people. Yeah.
And I have another one too.
Okay. You have another. See, they just keep coming. This is what this episode is. Sorry.
Yeah.
From letter 14 on humility. And oh my goodness, this has changed the way I view life. Because, you know, self-deprecation is a thing.
Yeah.
Screwtape says, "You must therefore conceal from the patient the true end of humility. Let him think of it not as self-forgetfulness, but as a certain kind of opinion, namely a low opinion of his own talents and character." Mm-hmm. Skipping forward a bit. "By this method, thousands of humans have been brought to think that humility means pretty women trying to believe they are ugly and clever men trying to believe they are fools." Mm-hmm. This is how I spent most of my teenage years, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, "Your efforts to instill either vainglory or false modesty into the patient will therefore be met from the enemy's side with the obvious reminder that a man is not usually called upon to have an opinion of his own talents at all, since he can very well go on improving them to the best of his ability without deciding on his own precise niche in the temple of fame." So I know that we and a lot of our listeners out there are clever, beautiful, virtuous women. And I know that we are often tempted to think that humility means pretending that none of that is true.
Yeah.
And yet Screwtape sets it right. You are not required to have an opinion. Letting go of yourself is way better than trying to pretend something that isn't true about yourself. Because as Screwtape points out, then you insert this little tension, this moment of tension of I believe that my humility requires me to believe something that I know to be false.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that this other definition of humility, this letting go of the self, this forgetfulness, this just focusing on, you know, the job that needs to be done, the talents that can be cultivated, taking delight in your work and seeing it done well without necessarily feeling that you are some kind of special something or other because of having done the work well.
Yeah.
That is, that was, has been very formative for me.
Agreed. Yeah. That also falls into the realm of accepting compliments from people.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Which is something I think many of us probably struggle with. I know I did for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what am I supposed to say when somebody says that I look beautiful or my dress is pretty or I sang a solo in a beautiful way? I'm like, oh, it was nothing. Like, that ignores that.
No, you know it wasn't nothing. You heard the solo. You knew you rocked it.
Right. So, like, that dismisses the fact that somebody else got joy from that, which isn't nothing. And the fact that God actually gifted you the ability to do that, or, you know, he gave you your beauty and these are all first article gifts. So, like, you're like shoving aside first article gifts. And that I realized that, I don't know, at some point in my 20s, I was like, oh, like there is a better way here. Like, acknowledging that, like, I'm glad you enjoyed that. Like, thanks be to God. And then moving on.
And then move on. Let it go.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's a quote shared by Carrie Ill, one of our former guests on the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's writing about from letter eight. She shares a quote that comes after a section discussing spiritual troughs. We've all experienced these times of dryness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where everything just seems bleak and God seems very far away.
Mm-hmm.
And Screwtape writes, "Our cause is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring but still intending to do our enemy's will, looks round upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished and asks why he has been forsaken but still obeys."
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That one is one that quote brought to mind. Like, there's a title of a book called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And yes, the quote you just, my guess is it was inspired by Lewis's statement there, or perhaps he's written elsewhere on the topic. But yeah, the idea, you're right, of just don't understand and you'll just trust and do it because of who he is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have one that Jenny Hurl also
also
put in from letter seven. I think this was one of the first ones I sent to you guys. And I was like, what is this? I had not forgotten my promise to consider whether we should make the patient an extreme patriot or an extreme pacifist. All extremes except extreme devotion to the enemy are to be encouraged. Not always, of course, but at this period. Some ages are lukewarm and complacent, and then it is our business to soothe them yet faster asleep. Other ages, of which the present is one, and still is, are unbalanced and prone to faction, and it is our business to inflame them. Uh-huh. I think I shrieked when I read that in the book. Like, this is so accurate.
Oh, yeah.
How much of our media and our consumption of many public things is meant to faction us and to name people as the other and to dehumanize everybody so that we have the right to be angry at them.
Uh-huh. Like,
guilty as charged.
Oh, man.
All right. I want to share one more quote. There's so many good ones, but Kathleen Mills, she had referenced part of a quote from letter 22 that is one of my favorites.
I have a feeling that I know which one you're going to do. Yeah. It was
my favorite character in the book, and we never even see her full on. It is the patient's love interest. After Screwtape and Wormwood have considered every possible woman in the neighborhood that he could be made to fall in love with to the detriment of his soul, he turns and falls in love with this girl who wasn't even in the report. And then they have to sort of scramble and perform some triage on the situation. But this description of this young woman is one that I have encouraged all of my daughters to take to heart, because it is such a wonderful little vignette. Screwtape writes, I have looked up this girl's dossier and am horrified at what I find. Not only a Christian, but such a Christian. A vile, sneaking, simpering, demure, monosyllabic, mouse-like, watery, insignificant, virginal bread and butter miss. The little brute. She makes me vomit. She stinks and scalds through the very pages of the dossier. Skipping a little bit. Looks as if butter wouldn't melt in her mouth and yet has a satirical wit. The sort of creature who'd find me funny.
He's so appalled, then he turns into a centipede, right?
Like, yeah, oh yeah, this is the letter at the end of it. He gets so angry and he turns into a centipede, and his secretary, Toadpipe, has to finish the letter on his behalf. And
I love it.
Some of the words that he uses to describe this girl are some that on the surface you'd be like, I'm not sure mouse-like is what any self-respecting woman would like to be called. And yet I think he's getting at sort of that there is something in her, a quality that would not be appreciated by the world, but that is nonetheless the true essence of quality.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I love that he's panicking over. She's just a girl. She's just a Christian young woman.
Uh-huh. Couldn't be worse.
Yeah. But this is one of the people I want to be when I grow up, is this young woman who would find Screwtape funny. And I do.
Yep. Accurate.
Yeah. Yes. So that is perhaps the funniest letter in the book, but also a really great challenge to us as Christian women, because one of the things that I love about this character is the way that God uses her to protect the patient from a range of other temptations. Because in the letters preceding this, Screwtape and Wormwood have been conspiring of how they can use this man's social circle to tempt him in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
Both socially and sexually. And as soon as she comes on the scene, that changes.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is he now immune from certain kinds of sexual temptation because of his friendship with this girl, but she also is drawing him into her community, her fellowship, the fellowship of her family, their greater household, their church community. She's pulling him in to a world that is at once more virtuous and more fun than any he's encountered. Very similar to what you were talking about with the Simone Weil quote of real good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She is experiencing real good, and she has invited him to participate in it as well. And so I think it really encourages us as Lutheran women to be that kind of person in the lives of the people we know and love, to be always inviting them into a different way of living and seeing the world that is, again, both better and more delightful than what they might have otherwise encountered.
Yeah.
Yes.
Full agree.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have finally earned the right to talk about the ending of the book. Did you cry at the ending?
No, but I rarely cry at books.
Okay.
It's not really a bar for me.
Okay. You don't have to. I cried for both of us.
I didn't cry at the ending, but I'll be honest. I don't think the last time I read this, and it has been quite some time, I really think I missed what happened at the end the last time, because when you were like, did you cry at the ending? I was like, oh, what's going on? So I'm like paying attention and I'm like, what? Wait, I feel like I don't think I connected fully the dots of what really happened at the end.
Yeah.
The first time I read it years ago, I think. Yeah, I don't think I realized. And so I was like, oh, I did not cry, but I had a far greater appreciation for what happened at the end than I did the first time I read it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the ending is the man dies.
Yeah.
The Blitz. Uh-huh. In the Battle of Britain. One moment, it seemed to be all our world, the scream of bombs, the fall of houses. Next moment, all this was gone like a bad dream. And this is some of the most beautiful writing, this last letter, 31. Just think, and let it be the beginning of your agony, Wormwood. What he felt at that moment, as if a scab had fallen from an old sore, as if he were emerging from a hideous shell-like tetter, as if he shuffled off for good and all a defiled, wet, clinging garment. By hell, it is misery enough to see them in their mortal days taking off dirtied and uncomfortable clothes and splashing in hot water and giving little grunts of pleasure, stretching their eased limbs. What then of this final stripping, this complete cleansing? And then, at the very end, he sees not only the angels coming to welcome, but then he saw not only them, he saw him.
Yeah.
And that's where And I don't want to get all Gnostic and be like, come sweet death, come sister Tod, because this life is good and beautiful, and the life in the body is a thing that is a great gift of God. But this idea that when God calls us home, we get to see everything that we're not seeing now about the spiritual reality.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We'll be aware of all the temptations and also all the ways that God has guarded us from those by his angels, by his word, by his spirit. And then we see him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So good.
Okay. Yeah. Brock Kleenex to this recording session. I told you I cry every time. I didn't expect that would be on air.
You did.
It's just that good.
It's just like so let's talk about how Screwtape loves, because it comes through perfectly in this last letter. Throughout this book, he has addressed Wormwood as my dear Wormwood. Mm-hmm. And signed every letter, your affectionate uncle, Screwtape. Mm-hmm. Leading us to believe that there is some mutual bond of affection between mm-hmm. them, because he says there is. So what exactly does Screwtape think of as love?
What I think of when I consider Thanksgiving dinner. yeah, consume.
Yeah.
Yes, love is about consumption. It's about desire.
Uh-huh.
He says in this letter, you ask whether the terms of my affection meant nothing from the beginning. Love you? Why, yes. As dainty a morsel as ever I grew fat on.
Uh-huh.
That this idea of... I know, right? But isn't that the way of the world?
Mm-hmm.
That we love to get something.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
To have our needs met by someone else in some way. That without the divine love teaching us how to love in a self-sacrificial way, on our own, we're no good at it. And as Screwtape himself confesses several times throughout the book, not privy to the secrets of divine love. That's right. All he's got left is this love that consumes.
Mm-hmm.
A desire to consume someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that is a kind of realization that you're right, Sarah, it makes you really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to. Like the contrast between what the patient is experiencing this chapter, the white light of divine love and revelation versus what we're left with in this lowerarchy situation, scrabbling over scraps
mm-hmm.
and the kind of love that only desires to tear apart and consume. It makes you want to run really fast towards the one and away from the other.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the ultimate point of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sort of like that old diet book, eat this, not that. Go this way.
Uh-huh.
Not that way.
Yeah.
Any last thoughts on this before we close the book?
I'm going to have to revisit it.
Yep.
Sooner than the gap between the last reading. I'm going to have to return again.
Good. Thankfully, it only takes 2.5 hours to read.
I know.
So it's not a huge commitment.
You're right. It's quick.
Unless you have the annotated version, then it takes you 4 days. Yeah. I can't wait to read it again. I think I might just take it in chunks, though.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, because each letter just has its own stuff.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm. 31 letters. It would take you most of the way through Lent. Probably get you about to Holy Week.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
True thought. I mean, that would be really soon, but I can do it.
Of course.
All right. Here we go. The closing of the 1944 hardback edition of the Screwtape Letters. A little soft.
That was a lovely slam.
Mm-hmm. And we need to pick a new book.
Yes, we do.
So our last question in the group was what they're reading right now and what genres everybody would enjoy reading next. Mm-hmm. There were not a whole lot of actionable suggestions in terms of what books people, specific books people might recommend.
Yeah.
But we had, I put in a poll. You know, I don't do polls very often. That's more your thing, Sarah. But yeah, I put in a poll of every genre I could think of that we've covered in the book club so far. You know, biographies, poetry, etc. And we did have some genres that were pulling ahead, and or three in particular: historical fiction, classic literature, and children's literature, or fairy tales, middle grade, YA, etc. That whole group. And then we also had a few votes for contemporary fiction and theology, Christian living. I was really proud of the 6% of respondents who voted for poetry or hymnody. Life is good when that happens. Given that our sort of top three genres all coincide in one book, I think that is to say classic historical fiction written for young people.
Yes.
I am going to propose that our next book club read be a book by the author Elizabeth Googe, more on her in a moment, called The Little White Horse. And this one comes highly recommended by J.K. Rowling, who apparently blurbed it saying, "I absolutely adored The Little White Horse."
Yeah. Nice. On the cover of the one on Amazon.
I know, right? Which is the one that my mother-in-law sent me. So my late mother-in-law, the Lutheran saint Brenda Bomberger, was one of the world's probably foremost living Elizabeth Googe fans. Because from the first time we started talking books, she'd be like, "Oh, you've got to read Elizabeth Googe." And I'm afraid I did not read my first Elizabeth Googe books until she was already in late stage Alzheimer's and we couldn't talk about it. One of my great regrets in life, because she was right. This is an author who deserves to be remembered more than she is.
Yeah.
And I now it's become sort of a holiday tradition. I told my father-in-law, if you find any more of these books from her collection, I want them all. Because I'm getting to know her even after after death by rereading the books that she knew and loved. And I understand her thought processes so much better. Because our books really form us, right?
Yeah.
Anyway. So, but this book was one that she actually took the trouble of finding on Amazon and sending me a copy of back in the day. And of course, I did not read it for a long time. But when I did, oh my goodness, I loved it. I read it out loud to my daughters. I gave a copy to my mother. She loved it. She gave it to one of my nephews. And it's just a really, really delightful story and perfect for spring and also for the Lenten and Easter seasons, because there's a lot in here about repentance and reconciliation and new opportunities for life and growth where things have been badly wrong for a really long time. Okay. It's a book about setting things right, even if you weren't the one who set them wrong. And it's kind of a bit of a fantasy fairy tale. They made a movie about it a few years ago. I really don't care for it. It's called The Secret of Moonacre, derived from the book, but really played up the witchcraft and played down the theology. There's a lot of theological undertow. I know, what a surprise. They also went really weird with the costumes, which, you know, like, not every Victorian novel needs to have a steampunk.
You're not endorsing.
Not endorsing the movie. It's kind of interesting.
This. They're like, "Oh, look, they made a movie." You're like, don't. No, this is not that's not
the book. The movie's fine. Just don't expect it to be as delightful as the books. Same old advice. Do expect that the book is going to contain not only more whimsy, more beauty, but also more theological undertones, which is one reason I really am excited to read it in this group in particular, because we love books that have theological undertones. Elizabeth Googe was actually, I believe, the daughter of an Anglican seminary professor. So she is no stranger to this sort of thing. So
she has come up in our book club discussions before. I remember.
You may have even heard my story before.
Yeah. Well, I because of that, it wasn't this book though. Mm-hmm. Well, this book might have also come up, but another Elizabeth Googe came up and we did not select it for a book club, and I ended up reading it, and it was a lovely book. It was The Bird in the Tree.
The Bird in the Tree. Yep. It's the first in a 3-part series on the Elliot family.
Yes.
And all three of them are just wonderful. Oh my goodness.
It was a delight. I thoroughly enjoyed it. So I'm excited to read this one.
Yeah.
So say the name of it again.
This one is The Little White Horse.
The Little White Horse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just
can't wait.
Don't be surprised when the little white horse turns out to be a mythical creature and probably a unicorn.
Oh, I'm in.
Sounds delightful.
I'm excited. Yes.
Oh, this book has everything. It has romance. It has unicorns. Mm. It has a really picturesque village vicar.
Okay.
It has a man of all work who also plays the string bass in the church orchestra.
I love it.
Yes. And it has a unicorn. So.
Uh-huh.
Yep. I'm in. We did The Princess and the Goblin, and that still is very high up on my list of favorites.
If you liked The Princess and the Goblin, you will like this.
All right.
Okay.
Can't wait.
Cool. Yeah. It's been fun. This was a good one.
We fully expected this to be...
Oh, we did.
Amazing. So this is for our book club happening in April.
Yes.
Okay.
And that will happen according to our current calendar. We will have book club in the beginning to middle of April. I think it'll end up being like that second week of April. Okay. So be on the lookout. Get your books, ladies.
Mm-hmm.
Little White Horse, Elizabeth Googe, available wherever books are sold.
Yeah, actually, this is one of the few, thanks to J.K. Rowling's endorsement, this is one of the few Elizabeth Googe books that you don't have to source from a used bookstore.
You can if you want to, mm-hmm. but it's also elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, nice. We are looking forward to it. This has been super fun. I always see book club forces me... happily forces me to read things that I wouldn't normally read, especially now in the middle of school. I'm like, oh, one more book. But there's always applications. So this is
great. I love it. Oh, and Sarah, you're going to love this one in particular because there's a whole lot of attention paid to fashion.
Ooh.
I know. Yeah, Maria Merriweather, the heroine, she's really into clothes.
Excellent.
Sounds great. This sounds
And I just said that, and like half the ladies out there listening were like, I'm out. Stick with me. It's worth it.
Also got a magical horse, though.
A magical horse. Yeah. So this
is something for everyone.
This sounds like a book that my niece, who is essentially my mini-me, would be.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, my daughters loved this book.
Because she's 8. So yeah.
This is a great one to share with your little Lutheran mini-me's out there because it is very wholesome.
I love it.
Cool.
All right. The Little White Horse, Elizabeth Googe. We will see y'all for the next book club in April. As a reminder, that happens asynchronously in our Facebook group. So Rachel will post the event in the group and we all join there. And then Rachel asks the questions and we all answer them. And it's a delightful time.
Mm.
So that's how that works. You can join us in our Facebook group, the Lutheran Ladies Lounge, and also our Instagram page at Lutheran Ladies Lounge for all of this content. We will post the book club questions on our Instagram page over the next week. If you're not on Facebook, you can still participate in that way. Also, if you're a guy happening to listen to this, our Instagram is public, so you can answer questions there if you'd like to. You can find all of our episodes at KFUO.org/Lutheran Ladies Lounge or on your favorite podcasting app or on the KFUO radio app. You're listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Rachel.
views and opinions expressed on the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast may not represent the official position of the management or ownership of KFUO Radio, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The Lutheran Ladies Lounge is produced by KFUO Radio and available at KFUO.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button and leave a review for us, too. If you love the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast, consider financially supporting our producer, KFUO Radio, so we can keep doing what we do. Find out how at KFUO.org/give.